Good morning. You're listening to KYRS, Thinner Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories, 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. Good Monday morning, Spokane. If you're listening to this, you survived Hoop Fest either by leaving or by enjoying it. There are people who do that, I hear, and I'm not one of them. So I'm back in town and refreshed after some camping, ready to talk about all kinds of things with you. As always, if you'd like to chime in on your safely on your commute or from home or work, you can call me at 509-747-3807. Today, I thought I'd get some history going, because we're in the week ramping up to the 4th of July, Independence Day in the U.S., and that's something that I want to focus on. I Noam Chomsky is a tough act to follow on alternative radio, but I'm going to give it a try. So, yeah. And if you were listening last week, I played an old show, and I got a ton of messages about it. So I rebroadcast a show called Rights, Privileges, Entitlements, Impediments from March 4th, 2013. So a little over a year old. And I got a lot of messages and comments from people that they really liked it. So it's actually up on the podcast page, despite being old. So if you caught part of that and wanted to hear it, if you ever want to hear an old show, they're hosted online back through almost a year old. So you can check that out at praxisradio509.podomatic.com, on the KYRS website, kyrs.org. On my website, truthscout.net. I think those are the main places you can find it. So thank you to everyone who liked that show. And now it is out there for you to find. So I thought talking about history, talking about the 4th of July and all of that, it dovetails in. I was working around Father's Day on an essay and some stuff for this show about fathers, actual fathers versus cultural fathers. And I'll talk a lot about the patriarchy on this show. And I think the main ones we have in the good old US of A are the founding fathers. These fellows who came from mostly Britain and declared independence and framed the Constitution, all those things we remember so well from school, in theory, and through our annual celebrations like the one that's coming up. And I think also this kind of Old Testament-y idea of God as the angry father watching you from the sky. So, yeah, working on that, and we'll see how far I get, but some of the Founding Father stuff will come out today. And as usual, Howard Zinn is my main man on the deep history research. And I've said it many times on the show, and I will say it again, that anyone who is interested in learning, you know, if not the perspective on the history of this country, another one that you aren't likely to have heard if you've studied, especially at the, you know, I really recommend it to high school students, Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, but also to people whose upper level education maybe didn't cover certain things. I think college is where some people start to get a glimpse behind the whitewashed tales that we receive earlier on, kind of a lot of it to the point of being mythology rather than actual events. And Howard Zinn, when he wrote People's History, did a really good job drilling through a lot of that and shifting the perspective of history. It's usually written by the people who win, in quotes, and used to further their aims. So he wrote this awesome book, and I'm going to read some of it to you, and I'm sure I will be stopping to interject pretty frequently, because that's how my attention span works. So this is from A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. He says, around 1776, certain important people in the English colonies made a discovery that would prove enormous enormously useful for the next 200 years. They found that by creating a nation, a symbol, a legal unity called the United States, they could take over land, profits, and political power from favorites of the British Empire. In the process, they could hold back a number of potential rebellions and create a consensus of popular support for the rule of a new, privileged leadership. When we look at the American Revolution this way, it was a work of genius, and the Founding Fathers deserve the odd tribute they have received over the centuries. They created the most effective system of national control devised in modern times and showed future generations of leaders the advantages of combining paternalism with command. That's a beautiful introduction. Starting with Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, by 1760, there had been 18 uprisings aimed at overthrowing colonial governments. There had also been 6 black rebellions from South Carolina to New York and 40 riots of various origins. By this time also, there emerged, according to Jack Green, stable, coherent, effective, and acknowledged local political and social elites. And by the 1760s, this local leadership saw the possibility of directing much of the rebellious energy against England and her local officials. It was not a conscious conspiracy, but an accumulation of tactical responses. After 1763, with England victorious over France in the Seven Years' War, known in America as the French and Indian War, expelling them from North America, ambitious colonial leaders were no longer threatened by the French. They now had only 2 rivals left, the English and the Indians. The British, wooing the Indians, had declared Indian lands beyond the Appalachians out of bounds to whites, the proclamation of 1763. Perhaps once the British were out of the way, the Indians could be dealt with. Again, no conscious forethought strategy by the colonial elite, but a growing awareness as events developed. With the French defeated, the British government could turn its attention to tightening control over the colonies. It needed revenues to pay for the war and looked to the colonies for that. Also, the colonial trade had become more and more important to the British economy and more profitable. It had amounted to about £500,000 in 1700, but by 1770 was worth £2.8 million. So the American leadership was less in need of English rule, the English more in need of the colonists' wealth. The elements were there for conflict. The war had brought glory for the generals, death to the privates, wealth for the merchants, unemployment for the poor. There were 25,000 people living in New York. There had been only 7,000 in 1720 when the French and Indian War ended. A newspaper editor wrote about the growing number of beggars and wandering poor in the streets of the city. Letters in the papers questioned the distribution of wealth. How often have our streets been covered with thousands of barrels of flour for trade, while our near neighbors can hardly procure enough to make a dumpling to satisfy hunger? Asked the paper. Gary Nash's study of city tax lists showed that by the early 1770s, the top 5% of Boston's taxpayers controlled 49% of the city's taxable assets. In Philadelphia and New York, too, wealth was more and more concentrated. Court-recorded wills showed that by 1750, the wealthiest people in the cities were leaving £20,000, equivalent to about $5 million today. So I'm going to continue that in just a minute. But yeah, I just think that the first time I read this book and started thinking about it this way, I really like that. I like Howard Zinn. I respect a lot because it can be really tempting. And I think this is why people known as conspiracy theorists get such a bad rap. It can be really tempting to see something like this and think, oh, they planned it all along. These guys must be the Illuminati after all. And while I think, you know, there have been people, generals and individuals like that, thinking 5 or 6 steps ahead in that sort of way. Oh, maybe we can be friends with England again. We can have a cross-Atlantic empire together and be allies right after this revolution ends. I like that he points out that it was a series of tactical steps that led to a very dramatic conclusion that was very advantageous for this small group of people. And we'll get more into that in a little bit further in the reading. So basically, the whole thrust of this chapter and his take on this period in history is that a large that while revolution was inevitable in the colonies, there were steps taken by the elite in the colonies, many of whom were still reporting to British corporations, that anger, it was a class anger. And they had to find a way to make it a nationalistic, patriotic anger against Britain rather than against the rich as a category. So we see that all the time. That's something that's been used over and over again. I think it's been used to great effect, unfortunately, by the moderate left in this country, who really have interests with the status quo, co-opting this energy from really, I mean, potentially revolutionary movements like Occupy that use this class language, that understand that distribution of wealth is a large part of these problems, of the power structures that we have. They want to, the people in these movements understand that because they are poor often, and they want to go after that as a target. But then suddenly, through this very sophisticated media apparatus and through all manner of organizations, through the Democratic Party, through, again, largely the media, and through the support of really, really, really kooky people further on the fascist front on the right in this country, we get, rather than the enemy being, you know, the rich or incorporated wealth or huge multinational corporations and the people who support them, it becomes something specific and meaningless like the Republican Party. You know, oh, it's just this party, and if we just vote these people out, the wealth will redistribute itself. And it's a really clever misdirection tactic that continues to work to this day. And a lot of it was not invented in America. America didn't invent everything, but this is definitely a really interesting example of these kind of semi-elite, colonial elite folks turning the gears of popular discontent for their own achievements. And I brought for contrast, because there are a lot of interesting stories. I think the story of America, no matter how you cut it, it's an interesting story. It's kind of an unprecedented project, I guess, in civilization's history. And especially as I learn more about about the history of civilization, which is history as we know it, and the effects that it's had, and the ways that hierarchy goes hand in hand with civilization, it's really interesting to reread some of what these so-called founding fathers had to say, that you know, their mission was to bring civilization, meaning all things progress, which is a word that we still hear a lot in kind of confusing contexts. And they wanted to bring that here and shine the light of civilization on the last untouched part of the world, or something like that. And I actually have, I'll be popping into this this article a little bit. This has some really incredible quotes that didn't make it into some of the history books, I think it's safe to say. It's from Indian Country Today Media Network. .com. That's a mouthful, but it's a good site. They have a lot of, they pull a lot of articles together from all over. And these are, well, this is part one. I should find the other part of this. So these span from the 1750s to 1817. So here's one from George Washington that didn't make the history books. The immediate objectives in the implied, in the attack on the native population here. The immediate objectives are the total destruction and devastation of their settlements and the capture of as many prisoners of every age and sex as possible. It will be essential to ruin their crops in the ground and prevent their planting more. Thanks, George. So, you know, we start with this nice story about pilgrims and everyone coming together for Thanksgiving and, you know, these kind, naive people teaching us to plant corn and all this. But then we hear this other side just a few years later, well, about 100 years later, from George Washington, the founding father of founding fathers, saying we need to ruin their crops, starve them out, and capture everyone because freedom. So yeah, let's see. Let's find another one from that era. Thomas Jefferson is an interesting one. I feel like people really, really want to like Thomas Jefferson and really want to make him a redemptive figure of the founding fathers. I feel like he's kind of the soft founding father some of the time. But he was, and one time or a couple times he mentioned being against the idea of slavery, yet he continued to personally enslave many people for his entire life. While he might have had a change of heart, he didn't have a change of action to follow it. So I think that alone discredits you from any kind of leadership in a human population. If you have those kind of beliefs, regardless of your time period, that's something else I'm going to talk about in a while. But he said, this is what Thomas Jefferson had to say about the natives here. He said, "This unfortunate race, whom we had been taking so much pains to save and to civilize, have by their unexpected desertion and ferocious barbarities justified extermination and now await our decision on their fate." Whew. So there's a lot of problematic things with that quote, as I'm sure you heard. Gave me goosebumps, actually. It's pretty upsetting that this is someone, I mean, my elementary school is named after this guy who's openly calling for genocide. That's what exterminate means. And he really embodies, I really like the way, I'm going to reread a part of what Howard Zinn says in this introduction. "Showed future generations of leaders the advantages of combining paternalism with command." I think this quote really shows the paternalistic aspect. It's this colonial mindset that, I mean, the word colonial, it's right in there. People coming who are very assured that they are from a better world. They're from the dirty and sewage-filled cities of Europe. What could be more beautiful in the 16th and 17th century, 18th? And there were interesting things happening culturally, art and all of that. But there was also a beautiful, intact culture here happening. And if this colonial mindset says that ours is better without learning about yours, and the only way for you to survive is to learn our ways or go away. And the going away part is not pretty, and it's not something that just happens. There are people planning it, carrying it out, and it's something we still see through today with the indigenous population here and all over the parts of the world that have been colonized. So, yeah, the founding fathers thing, I just think that expression is so interesting the more I think about it. It's this idea of our dad, I'm the founding father speaking right now, our dad, who's the big father, this Old Testament-y idea of God, tells us that we can, you know, conquer for Christianity and for profit and progress and all those good things that we want. And yeah, he trusts us to carry out the work. So we're your fathers now. Hi, welcome to the family. Do what I say or else. So anyway, I have some more of these unfortunate founding fathers quotes that didn't make it into the books, but I'm going to continue on and give you a little bit more of this Howard Zinn, which I hope other people enjoy as much as me. I'm kind of a history nerd, but yeah, I'm just really fond of it. And it's interesting to see the way that what I remember from, and I'm going to focus on primary and secondary school because I think that's when we're forming our frames of the world. That's when we're forming what we understand the basic premises of life to be. We form those when we're children. So what we're learning in school as children is a lot about this time period. I remember never getting to recent history, but always talking about the founding of the country, building replicas of houses in Jamestown, things like this, and learning about there really is a focus on this rebellious spirit. These colonists just wanted to be free. They didn't want a king. We don't have a king around here. We're free people and we lead ourselves. And they didn't shy away from the revolutionary language and from talking about, I mean, property destruction as a political tactic. Like, that's a key part of what people learn in school, the Boston Tea Party. It would never be endorsed as something to use today politically. people who do that now are usually called vandals or terrorists or something like that. But we really, you know, we hold that up. New fringe political parties get named after it. It's something we remember. And what I love about Howard Zinn and his writing is that he keeps all of those events that happened, because they happened. The Boston Tea Party happened. But he fills in around the edges things that got kind of left out of the story the first time. So this whole idea that I was talking about, if you're just tuning in, of the class anger, of the huge mass of enslaved people, indentured servants, women, and natives, understandably, who in organized and disorganized ways had a lot of grievances, to say the least, with the land-owning, wealthy white British elite in the country, and the way that these same elite used really sophisticated techniques, which I'm going to get into the details of, to redirect that anger from them and British elite, to just the British, forming kind of the kernel of this early nationalism that we see in, I guess it's in its mature state today, to disastrous effect. So I'm going to keep on sharing this with you from the chapter title here in People's History of the United States is Tyranny is Tyranny. And yeah, I don't want people to assume, people who might be critical listening to the show, that this is my only book. I reference it a lot on the show. I use it more than any other book. It's getting kind of tattered from getting hauled around. But it's, I mean, I have yet to find, if someone has found, please tell me, I've yet to find a better basic history text. It's really well researched. I use his sources all the time if I need to get deeper into something. It's really a book that I think every person should have. And there's lots of copies of it out there, so that's good for you. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Praxis talking about independence, this whole idea of Independence Day, and a little retelling of history, talking about the good old founding fathers, which is a tradition, a 4th of July tradition, dating back 3 years, I believe. So here we are, from the founding mother of Praxis. And if you have that book, sorry to continue to be scattered. If you do have other suggestions of great texts like this, resources online or anything, please send them to me. My email is praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org. So I'm going to continue this. So in Boston, where we just described the drastic wealth inequality, almost as bad as it is today, the lower classes began to use the town meeting to vent their grievances. The governor of Massachusetts had written that in these meetings, the meanest inhabitants, by their constant attendance there, generally are the majority and outvote the gentlemen, merchants, substantial traders, and all the better part of the inhabitants. So the riffraff are getting into the meetings because there's more of them in numbers than rich people. What seems to have happened in Boston is that certain lawyers, editors, and merchants of the upper classes, but excluded from the ruling circles close to England, men like James Otis and Samuel Adams, organized a Boston caucus and through their oratory and their writing, molded laboring class opinion, called the mob, into action and shaped its behavior. This is Gary Nash's description of Otis, who, he says, keenly aware of the declining fortunes and the resentment of ordinary townspeople, was mirroring as well as molding popular opinion. We have here a forecast of the long history of American politics, the mobilization of lower class energy by upper class politicians for their own purposes. This was not purely deception. It involved, in part, a genuine recognition of lower class grievances, which helps to account for its effectiveness as a tactic over the centuries. As Nash puts it, James Otis, Samuel Adams, Royal Tyler, Oxenbridge Thatcher, great British name, and a host of other Bostonians, linked to the artisans and laborers through a network of neighborhood taverns, fire companies, and the caucus, espoused a vision of politics that gave credence to laboring class views and regarded as entirely legitimate the participation of artisans and even laborers in the political process. So this idea that is still pervasive This is what people claim that the beauty of America is, and many people believe is the case, that we have a democracy and that everybody that, you know, Joe the plumber, as the classic example, can participate in a meaningful way. That is not true. Research now shows I'm not just a crazy person saying that's not true. It's actually just not true. Anyway, back to Zinn. In 1762, Otis, speaking against the conservative rulers of the Massachusetts colony, represented by Thomas Hutchinson, gave an example of the kind of rhetoric that a lawyer could use in mobilizing city mechanics and artisans. "I am forced to get my living by the labor of my hand and the sweat of my brow, as most of you are, and obliged to go through good report and evil report for bitter bread, earned under the frowns of some who have no natural or divine right to be above me, and entirely owe their grandeur and honor to grinding the faces of the poor." Which brings to mind Barack Obama saying, "You didn't build that." Anyway, speaking of lawyers with great rhetoric skills, Boston seems to have been full of class anger in those days. In 1763, in the Boston Gazette, someone wrote that a few persons in power were promoting political projects for keeping the people poor in order to make them humble. This accumulated sense of grievance against the rich in Boston may account for the explosiveness of mob action after the Stamp Act of 1765. And I think, do we remember the Stamp Act? New tax. People rebelled in mass, including property destruction, targeting individual tax collectors, looting their homes, tactics that definitely would not be endorsed today, but, you know, are generally explained away in this kind of whitewashed version of history as, you know, things were just so bad that maybe it was justified, and look, it worked out in the end. And it's the only time people are allowed to do that is in the past. We'd never do that again. People sitting in public parks for a month is not acceptable. But back then, harassing a debt collector, and you know, burning him in effigy outside his house, that was a-okay because it was for a good goal. That's not me saying that. It's my imaginary history analyst saying that. So they go on to describe these mobs destroying these homes, and really the mob going pretty wild. And Zinn goes on to say, "It was one of those moments in which fury against the rich went further than leaders like Otis wanted. Could class hatred be focused against the pro-British elite and deflected from the nationalist elite? In New York, that same year of the Boston House attacks, someone wrote to the New York Gazette, 'Is it equitable that 99, rather 999, should suffer for the extravagance or grandeur of one, especially when it is considered that men frequently owe their wealth to the impoverishment of their neighbors? The leaders of the revolution would worry about keeping such sentiments within limits.'" So a letter to the editor in, let's see, what year are we in now? Stamp Act? 1765. I don't know who wanted to claim credit for "We Are the 99%, but it seems like someone beat you to it in 1765. "Is it equitable that 99, rather 999, should suffer for the extravagance or grandeur of one?" That's really awesome. So these were the same sentiments being talked about, you know, 250 years before these more recent bubblings up in this country. And they were being made by people who were laboring for some as paid wage laborers, but many paying off their contract of indentured servitude. They're paying their way over to these colonies in their labor. Many people, not who were writing letters to the editor, because they did not have the right to do that, but also people, you know, who had been kidnapped for their labor and would continue to be exploited in that way for another 100 years. And today, now, you know, it's in really similar ways. Students who are in debt, they're paying off with their free labor at internships and other places. They're paying with their free labor for a ticket, you know, supposedly to the upper classes in a similar way that is not paying off for them. You know, people, the indentured servants, part of the reason there was so much anger is that there weren't a lot of avenues at this time for them to acquire their own property, to start, you know, living the life they had expected to be able to start when they got there. They were still kind of drudging along and not pleased with it. So anyway, there's a lot of class anger going on during this time, this revolutionary time. We're going to need to move it along if we're going to get there. So I'm going to skip forward. I'm glad I marked this all up last night. So this is just a continuation of what we're just talking about. The leaders of the movement against the Stamp Act include the leaders being this political elite with some level of property and power, had instigated crowd action through their rhetoric we talked about earlier, but then became frightened by the thought that it might be directed against their wealth too. At this time, the top 10% of Boston's taxpayers held about 66% of Boston's taxable wealth, while the lowest 30% of the taxpaying population had no property at all. The propertyless could not vote, and so, like blacks, women, and Indians, could not participate in town meetings. This included sailors, journeymen, apprentices, servants. Dirk Horder, a student of Boston mob actions in the revolutionary period, calls the revolutionary leadership the Sons of Liberty type drawn from middling interest and well-to-do merchants, a hesitant leadership, wanting to spur action against Great Britain, yet worrying about maintaining control over the crowds at home. It took the Stamp Act crisis to make this leadership aware of its dilemma. A political group in Boston called the Loyal Nine, merchants, distillers, ship owners, and master craftsmen who opposed the Stamp Act, organized a procession in August 1765 to protest it. They put 50 master craftsmen at the head, but needed to mobilize ship workers from the North End and mechanics and apprentices from the South End. 2,000 or 3,000 were in the procession. They marched to the home of the stamp master and burned his effigy. But after the gentleman who organized the demonstration left, the crowd went further and destroyed some of the stamp master's property. These were, as one of the Loyal Nine said, amazingly inflamed people. The Loyal Nine seemed taken aback by the direct assault on the wealthy furnishings of the stamp master. The rich set up armed patrols. Now a town meeting was called, and the same leaders who had planned the demonstration denounced the violence and disavowed the actions of the crowd. Something we've never seen again since. People may remember times when this is uncomfortably familiar. As more demonstrations were planned for November 1st, 1765, when the Stamp Act was to go into effect, and for Pope's Day, November 5th, steps were taken to keep things under control. A dinner was given for certain leaders of the rioters to win them over. And when the Stamp Act was repealed, due to overwhelming resistance, the conservative leaders severed their connections with the rioters. They held annual celebrations of the first anti-Stamp Act demonstration, to which they invited, according to Herder, not the rioters, but mainly upper and middle class Bostonians who traveled in coaches and carriages to Roxbury or Dorchester for opulent feasts. So, again, I mean, this whole idea of picking a few of the leaders of the street level mob, that group, and, you know, taking them out and courting them. And in the very same way that a new, fresh, you know, state senator or senator, maybe with some really lofty ideas, maybe with some great connections to people, maybe a background in organizing, will get taken out to a lot of dinners just like that today. And they seem to have an effect on just about everyone who gets into this process. And this is kind of it's not the political process that we think of when we think about politics in the American way that we tend to. It's not an election. It's not anything like that. But it's a conversation over, you know, a nice steak dinner and some wine, maybe a lot of wine. And, you know, you realize these guys aren't bad guys. Maybe they are just rich because they worked harder than me. You know, there's a lot that goes into the psychology of that. And yeah, we see it time and time again, and it's too bad. So this is part of that strategy that's really been refined, I would argue, over time. That these early, they're not the founding fathers yet. Nothing's been founded yet. We're almost there in the story. But these elite, the Sons of Liberty, being kind of a good blanket title for this group of rabble-rousers, but, you know, wanting to keep, not lose their scholarship, you know? They don't want to lose their ticket to the upper crust. They don't want to leave their position in the upper crust. But they also don't want to, they don't want to share the crust. They don't want to redistribute the wealth or anything crazy like that. So 1765, the Stamp Act, we have all these big demonstrations. The Stamp Act gets repealed. 1768, the issues that the colonists have with the British are beginning to include impressment and quartering of troops. Basically, the law was that if British troops came to your town, showed up at your door, you just had to house and feed them, regardless of your own economic standing. If you're having trouble feeding your kids, too bad, you have to feed this grown man who's a soldier and has quite an appetite. And that's just how it is. So, and the soldiers also began to take the jobs of working people when jobs were scarce. So there's a lot of distress among people, people who already have jobs, not this 30% of propertyless, jobless people, but I guess what couldn't yet be called the middle class. There's the laboring class is having a lot of anxiety, even more building up. So we're getting closer and closer to 1776. Let's see. Sorry, I'm finding my spot. We get to the Boston Massacre in 1770, which you may have heard about. By 1773, we're at the Boston Tea Party, which is often considered one of these actions along the way. So this isn't a peaceful revolution. It's one filled with property destruction, rioting, casualties, etc. It's an interesting story. I can see how why it's focused on so much, but I think we need to hear the whole thing. So I'm going to skip forward in the story again. So the Sons of Liberty. Here we go. Thanks for your patience letting me flip through the pages. I do have a real book in the studio today. It's a charming thing to have these days. Pauline Meyer, who studied the development of opposition to Britain in the decade before 1776, in her book From Resistance to Revolution, emphasizes the moderation of the leadership and, despite their desire for resistance, their emphasis on order and restraint. She notes, the officers and committee members of the Sons of Liberty were drawn almost entirely from the middle and upper classes of colonial society. In Newport, Rhode Island, for instance, the Sons of Liberty, according to a contemporary writer, contained some gentlemen of the first figure in town for opulence, sense, and politeness. In North Carolina, one of the wealthiest of the gentlemen and freeholders led the Sons of Liberty. Similarly, in Virginia and South Carolina. And New York's leaders, too, were involved in small but respectable independent business ventures. Their aim, however, was to broaden their organization to develop a mass base of wage earners. To incorporate is what we call that today, I believe, unless I'm misreading that. Many of the Sons of Liberty groups declared, as in Milford, Connecticut, their greatest abhorrence of lawlessness, or, as in Annapolis, opposed all riots or unlawful assemblies tending to the disturbance of the public tranquility. John Adams expressed the same fears. These tarrings and featherings, this breaking open houses by rude and insolent rabbles, in resentment for private wrongs or in pursuing of private prejudices and passions, must be discountenanced. In Virginia, it seemed clear to the educated gentry that something needed to be done to persuade the lower orders to join the revolutionary cause, to deflect their anger against England. One Virginian wrote in his diary in the spring of 1774, "The lower class of people here are in tumult on account of reports from Boston. Many of them expect to be pressed and compelled to go and fight the Britons." Around the time of the Stamp Act, a Virginia orator addressed the poor. "Are not the gentlemen made of the same materials as the lowest and poorest among you? Listen to no doctrines which may tend to divide us, but let us go hand in hand as brothers." That's so sweet. That's such a nice idea. yeah. It was a problem for which the rhetorical talents of Patrick Henry were superbly fitted. He was, as Rise Isaac puts it, firmly attached to the world of the gentry, but he spoke in words that the poorer whites of Virginia could understand. Henry's fellow Virginian, Edmund Randolph, recalled his style as simplicity and even carelessness. His pauses, which for their length might sometimes be feared to dispel the attention, riveted it more by raising the expectation. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Patrick Henry's oratory in Virginia pointed a way to relieve class tension between upper and lower classes and form a bond against the British. This was to find language inspiring to all classes, specific enough in its listing of grievances to charge people with anger against the British, vague enough to avoid class conflict among the rebels, and stirring enough to build patriotic feeling for the resistance movement. That is a tall order. The thing that I think I romanticize the most about this era in history is the role of the orator, the public speaking fascination that people had. The fact that people could get up on a soapbox and talk for 2 hours and have a crowd there for 2 hours is just really fascinating. That was still a major in college until fairly recently in the grand scheme of things. But I just find this whole section fascinating, especially after focusing on propaganda for a while over the last couple months on this show. There's really a lot that went into massaging public sentiment into the right kind of action. And that's what is so interesting and what Howard Zinn chronicles so well here in A People's History of the United States. That is what I'm reading from. If you're just joining me, if you're just tuning in the car or at work or something like that, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and today we're talking a little bit about Independence Day coming up this Thursday and just some thoughts about it, some thoughts about how it all went down and how we should maybe consider our relationship to the so-called Founding Fathers, particularly in light of what was going on in history. So I'm going to finish this propaganda bit and then talk a little bit about morals and such. So anyway, they needed some kind of message, and it has to be vague, but it has to be specific, and it has to make people angry, but it also has to make them feel like they can win. And this is basic organizing knowledge. There's a little acronym in organizing, AHUI, which says agitate. Why can't I remember the H? Well, never mind about the acronym. I'll tell you if I remember later. Continuing in the reading, Tom Paine's Common Sense, which I believe we've all heard and many were made to read even today, almost 300 years later in school. Tom Paine's Common Sense, which appeared in early 1776 and became the most popular pamphlet in the American colonies, did this. It made the first bold argument for independence in words that any fairly literate person could understand. Quote, "Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil." Paine disposed of the idea of the divine right of kings by a pungent history of the British monarchy, going back to the Norman conquest of 1066, when William the Conqueror came over from France to set himself on the British throne. A French bastard landing with an armed banditti and establishing himself King of England against the consent of the natives is, in plain terms, a very paltry, rascally original. It certainly hath no divinity in it. Don't hold back, Tom. Tell us how you really feel. Paine dealt with the practical advantages of sticking to England or being separated. He knew the importance of economics. He said, "I challenge the warmest advocate for reconciliation to show a single advantage that this continent can reap by being connected with Great Britain. I repeat the challenge. Not a single advantage is derived. Our corn will fetch its price in any market in Europe, and our imported goods must be paid for by them where we will." As for the bad effects of the connection with England, Paine appealed to the colonists' memory of all the wars in which England had involved them, wars costly in lives and money. "But the injuries and disadvantages which we sustain by that connection are without number. Any submission to or dependence on Great Britain tends directly to involve this continent in European wars and quarrels and set us at variance with nations who would otherwise seek our friendship." He built slowly to an emotional pitch. Everything that is right or reasonable pleads for separation. The blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature cries, 'tis time to part. Lovely words, indeed. Pretty compelling stuff. And it's taken out of context, out of the context of what happened next and what was already being planned, as we're seeing through through this kind of sub-story that many people haven't heard or haven't considered. Monarchy is a bad idea. Yeah, it's really strange to just have a family in charge forever, have brute force be the way that power is obtained, if that's to be challenged, divine right, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, I don't want that either. That seems like a great idea. And then this advantages and disadvantages section is true, objectively. If you just ignore the fact that, you know, the natives could be really saying the same thing about the colonists. Like, hey, we don't have an advantage from having these people here. They're getting us sick. They're destroying our crops. They're bringing all this filth, these weird, unsanitary ways of doing things into our systems that have been working for us pretty well. Why should we have them here? Meanwhile, we can continue to have our tribal affiliations, our culture, our traditions that we've had for tens of thousands of years on this continent, uninterrupted without them. It's just really interesting to think about that. There are really interesting writings from that time, what survived in the oral history and everything from the native perspective of these people coming. You could really probably put a lot of these words right in people's mouths and have it make sense. Common Sense went through 25 editions in 1776 and sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It is probable that almost every literate colonist either read it or knew about its contents. Pamphleteering had become by this time the chief theater of debate about relations with England. From 1750 to 1776, 400 pamphlets had appeared arguing one or the other side of the Stamp Act, or the Boston Massacre, or the Tea Party, or the general questions of disobedience to law, loyalty, and government, to government rights and obligations. Paine's pamphlet appealed to a wide range of colonial opinion angered by England, but it caused some tremors in aristocrats like John Adams, who were with the Patriot cause but wanted to make sure it didn't go too far in the direction of democracy. Paine had denounced the so-called balanced government of Lords and Commons as a deception, and called for single-chamber representative bodies where the people could be represented. Adams, one of our founding fathers, you may remember, denounced Paine's plan as so democratical, without any restraint or even an attempt at any equilibrium or counterpoise, that it must produce confusion and every evil work. Popular assemblies needed to be checked, Adams thought, because they were productive of hasty results and absurd judgments. There's a lot we could say today about absurd judgments from this form of government that John Adams advocated for, which prevailed, the Lords and Commons, the representative separated model. They make hasty judgments and absurd judgments, and yeah, it didn't work out the way he might have thought. But Paine himself came out of the lower orders of England, a staymaker, tax official, teacher, poor immigrant to America. He arrived in Philadelphia in 1774, when agitation against England was already strong in the colonies. The artisan mechanics of Philadelphia, along with journeymen, apprentices, and ordinary laborers, were forming into a politically conscious militia, in general, damned riffraff, dirty, mutinous, and disaffected, as local aristocrats described them. By speaking plainly and strongly, he could represent those politically conscious lower-class people. He opposed property qualifications for voting in Pennsylvania. But his great concern seems to have been to speak for a middle group. There is an extent of riches, as well as an extreme of poverty, which by harrowing the circles of a man's acquaintance, lessens his opportunities of general knowledge. And that was Tom Paine who said that. Oh, So basically, Common Sense becomes one of the main propaganda tools to really, really get the average person to decide that, yes, independence from Britain is the way to go. Let's do it. Here are some leaders already qualified who understand how we can do it. Let's make it happen. Let's use our rebellious, youthful, colonial energy to get our freedom and become the greatest nation on earth. That's kind of the story that we hear. And this is a lot of what rallied people to support that in a unified way, which was what was most important at the time. So, slowly, these different groups, the Sons of Liberty, the Stamp Act, rebellion leaders, the Committees of Correspondence, the Boston Tea Party, finally, all these groups together in 1774 set up a Continental Congress, an illegal body, forerunner of a future independent government. It was after the military clash at Lexington and Concord in April 1775 between colonial minutemen and British troops that the Continental Congress decided upon separation. They organized a small committee to draw up the Declaration of Independence, which Thomas Jefferson wrote. It was adopted by the Congress on July 2nd and officially proclaimed July 4th, 1776, the big day. You may notice, though, the astute listener or reader has noticed that this group, the Continental Congress, self-elected illegal body, let's remember that, decided that independence was the way to go in April 1775. Thomas Paine then is promoted, mass-printed, with common sense, calling for that in the public eye in early 1776. So, in practical terms, the decision has already been made. The public support just needs to be rallied in the direction that's been chosen already. Something that we unfortunately see pretty frequently in unbalanced power structures like this one. By this time, there was already a powerful sentiment for independence. Resolutions adopted in North Carolina in May of 1776 and sent to the Continental Congress declared independence of England, asserted that all British law was null and void, and urged military preparations. About the same time, the town of Malden, Massachusetts, responding to a request from the Massachusetts House of Representatives that all towns in the state declare their views on independence, had met in a town meeting and unanimously called for independence. "We therefore renounce with disdain our connection with a kingdom of slaves. We bid a final adieu to Britain." When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands, they should declare the causes. This was the opening of the Declaration of Independence. Then, in its second paragraph, came the powerful philosophical statement. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government." It then went on to list grievances against the king, a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. The list accused the king of dissolving colonial governments, controlling judges, sending swarms of officers to harass our people, sending in armies of occupation, cutting off colonial trade with other parts of the world, taxing the colonists without their consent, and waging war against them, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny. All this, the language of popular control over governments, the right of rebellion and revolution, indignation at political tyranny, economic burdens, and military attacks, was language well suited to unite large numbers of colonists and persuade even those who had grievances against one another to turn against England. Some Americans were clearly omitted from this circle of united interests drawn by the Declaration of Independence: Indians, black slaves, women. Indeed, one paragraph of the Declaration charged the king with inciting slave rebellions and Indian attacks. "He has excited domestic insurrections among us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." So, and it goes on a little bit to talk more about that. I'm going to talk about it in my own terms outside of the book, partially because it's really exhausting to read aloud. I do it a little faster than I talk. But so the Declaration of Independence is a really powerful document. It's powerfully written, written by primarily Thomas Jefferson. One of the reasons we remember him so well, and again, we don't remember all those unfortunate things that he said that I mentioned earlier. We don't remember necessarily the slaves that he, the people that he claimed ownership of and kept in captivity to work for him at his manor, which is large, been there. But you know, he wrote these really lovely words, and it is an interesting, I think one of the strengths, I hesitate to even say it, one of the strengths of the Tea Party today, kind of before it got into the electoral realm and when it was a bunch of kind of angry people, one of the strengths was that a lot of the people involved had an obsession with this period of history, hence their name, the Tea Party, in reference to the Boston Tea Party, but really invoked that language. When governments stop working, we abolish them. And that is, I think, the idea that has been not remembered as well in the Declaration of Independence. And it would be really interesting to see, it has been interesting to see, when we look at things like Envision Spokane, a story that I've covered on an ongoing basis through my time here in Spokane, people looking to basically rewrite the city charter in ways that violate the U.S. Constitution, but protect the environment in ways that the federal government refuses to, protect people's rights in ways the federal government refuses to, acknowledge the fact that corporations are not people. And when these things go forth through the legal system, they have failed. They've largely, at least here in Spokane, they've been kept off of the ballot. They were voted down once before, barely voted down a second time, and then preemptively struck from the ballot by the city council, by the existing government. So the ways, the polite ways, haven't worked. There haven't been many mobs and riots in the last 10 to 15 years in the U.S., but, you know, mass movements like, I mean, Occupy being the best example, Idle No More being a First Nations example, these strategies that we've talked about for the last hour, really carefully deployed, have done a lot of work to keep those movements from reaching maturity and from really seizing power for a mass group of people, or at least realizing actual democracy, not what we have here. So I want to mention one last thing. I'm almost out of time, but a lot of times there are people who realize today, we realize in 2014, that, you know, maybe it wasn't okay to kidnap millions of people and bring them to the colonies as slaves. That wasn't okay. And it wasn't okay to displace hundreds of thousands to millions of people from their land that they've lived on for thousands of years and destroy the capacity for them to continue their way of life. And maybe it wasn't okay to disclude women from every part of civic life and also own them contractually as chattel. All that was bad, but people just didn't know any better back then. That was just the way things were, and it's too bad. And we've learned. We should still, in their context, these founding fathers were still good people. And I just think it's time to totally reject that notion. I don't know. There's what's normal now culturally is that we're perpetually at war, and that, you know, you can kill people with drones if they live somewhere where there might be terrorists, because terrorism's bad. That's a culturally normative idea, that, you know, we have to protect the world from itself. We have to protect people from the violence of Islam or, you know, whatever these cultural myths are, people will go along with horrific things, with war, with, they'll pay for it. They'll go and do the work. They'll work for, buy from, do their life's exchanges with huge corporations. And, you know, that's just the way things are. I just think that it's time to reject that idea. People have responsibility. There's difficulties associated with living in a time where that's the dominant culture, but I just don't think it's a valid excuse. So these guys aren't my fathers. None of them are my father, thankfully. If you listened 2 weeks ago, you heard my real father, who I tend to respect a lot more than these folks. And like I said, they have these really, this is what you need to know about the founding fathers. This is a little later on. This is Governor William Henry Harrison, who was a big advocate of displacing the native population on the East Coast. He said, "Is one of the fairest portions of the globe to remain in a state of nature, the haunt of a few wretched savages, when it seems destined by the Creator to give support to a large population and to be the seat of civilization?" So again, the colonial mindset, our way is better than your way, so get out of the way, and someday we'll let you play, women and people of color and everyone else. So, Just a few thoughts for Independence Day. I'm going a little bit over time. I wanted to also make sure, I want to say a quick, I don't have time to pull it up, but Russ Nobbs, who many people in this community know, he founded Rings and Things. I met him when he was running recycling, basically on a single man crew for all the big public events like Earth Day, like many of the street fairs, Art Fest. That's how I met him. He's a really just wonderful, dedicated guy. Brought a lot of recycling, composting to these events. That's the context I know him in. Was just a great friend to the progressive community in Spokane and to people who knew him. He passed away on Friday, and just wanted to say thanks, Russ, for all your work, and thanks to the great legacy of getting stuff done here and having a great attitude about it. He always just had a twinkle in his eye and a smile while he was schlepping around garbage on a cart, and got people really motivated to just do what you can while you're here. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. So thanks, Russ. Happy trails wherever you may be. And have a great day to everyone out there in the world. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.